I'm going to try something a little bit different in this episode. It's going to be a little bit more personal and a little bit more of a behind-the-scenes glimpse into my personal creative process. This is particularly interesting now because I'm right on the edge of burned out. Hello, my name is Brad McIntyre, and you are listening to the Cultivated Playwright podcast, episode number 17. Tomorrow is July 20th, 2019. Tomorrow night, I will world premiere a brand new one-person show that I have been creating and working on. It is called The Beast of Hyperborea. It will be a part of a festival called The FIT, or F-I-T, the Festival of Independent Theaters. This is a Dallas-based festival. It's pretty local, pretty regional. It's usually small theater companies, like the title would suggest, independent companies, often by emerging artists. None of us have homes. None of the companies have home venues. We float around the city, renting venues as we go along. I've participated in this festival a number of times, actually. This will be my, sixth or seventh time in the, eighth time in the FIT. It is the 21st annual FIT Festival. It's been going for quite a while. Anyway, it is unique how this play has come together this time. The creative process has been similar to times gone by, but everything is on an accelerated time scale for this particular project, and I will explain why that is as I go forward. I plan to do this particular podcast in two parts, so consider this part one, and this is the lead-up. After the show premieres tomorrow night, I will do a follow-up part two for this particular episode, and we'll see if I pulled it off. So, back in February, I had an idea for a play. My idea at the time was to write a one-person show, and it would be sort of in the vein of Victorian adventure fiction. You know, like H.G. Wells and Arthur Conan Doyle and Jules Verne, that sort of thing, where the protagonists go on a trip to an exotic place and experience exotic creatures in some way, and then, bring it back to some sort of like Victorian version of a National Geographic Society. So I started working on this idea, and the idea came to me about 2 weeks or so. Yeah, this was in mid to late February. The idea came to me just before the submission deadline for this festival I just referred to, The FIT. So I had to put together a proposal for this festival to submit to see if I could get into the festival. And I was thinking, I have until July. The festival is in the middle of the summer, and this is late February. I have plenty of time to write and put together a show. So I'll propose it, and if I get in, if I'm accepted, then I'll put the show together. I'll have plenty of warning. This will be all right. So I did. I submitted, and in late March, early April, I was informed, yes, you are in the festival. Congratulations. Have your show ready and bring it completed and ready to go. All the best. So I started making notes for the show. I carried around in my sketchbook, as I usually do. I let the ideas percolate. I looked over some adventure fiction from the late 1800s, mid to late 1800s, early 1900s, and made some notes and things. I was also, I should admit, because I'm always curious how people get ideas for plays and how their ideas and concepts kind of shape up by the influences that act upon them, What influenced me when I was thinking about this show in particular was a chapter in a book that I have been reading called The Seven Basic Plots, which I'll put a link to in the show notes on the website. One of the plots outlined is overcoming the monster or facing the beast, that kind of plot. And this is done all the time in a variety of different kinds of fiction, be it movies or plays or literature. Think Jaws or Dracula or Twister. Remember that movie Twister with Bill Paxton? I don't know why I'm using that as an example. It's not the strongest example. But St. George and the Dragon, it is the overcoming of a monster, facing one's fears, and the fears are represented, or anxiety, or whatever the protagonist is dealing with. It's kind of represented in this monster, and this monster has to be overcome. And there are familiar tropes in this particular kind of plot that show up over and over again. And it really intrigued me. I should say, this particular kind of writing, this particular kind of plot, constricts and then releases, throughout. So there's a series of close calls and narrow getaways, and it's what makes this kind of thing exciting. And I thought to myself, well, this would be a wonderful thing to write. And I was looking for an idea for my next one-person show, and I thought, well, let's do this. Let's make one of these kinds of plots with kind of set in the late 1800s, and it should be a lot of fun. Now, skip forward to May and then June. I was, at the time, producing a performance festival of my own called the Dallas Solo Fest, and it was filled with a variety of challenges this year. And it took up a great deal of my time. It took up a great deal of my energy. And basically, it is a festival that brings in performers from all over the country here to the Dallas area. And they perform their one-person shows over the course of a two-week festival, including a couple of locals. And as I referenced in the previous episode of this podcast, I was one of the performers this year because it was in its fifth year. And I... I knew that my show would be ready to go, basically. I knew I would have a show with the requisite production photos and blurbs and all the things that I ask for from performers. I would not have to worry about if I did one of the shows myself. And it was my own solo performance festival, and I had made it to year five. I figured it was about time that I could get away with performing one of my own shows in it without it seeming too, pretentious. I'd held off doing it for a while. I didn't want it to... Solo performance is narcissistic on its own, or it's perceived that way by critics and some audience members and some fellow theater artists. And so I kept away from doing my show, one of my own solo shows in my own solo festival, until just this year. But what it meant is it doubled the amount of work that I had to do, because I didn't just worry about the festival and marketing it as a whole and producing it as a whole. I also had to worry about my own individual one-person show that was inside of that festival. All this is to say, I did not get around to really writing, really doing any deep work on this play for the fit until after the Dallas Solo Fest ended. The Dallas Solo Fest ended in mid-June. It ended on, I believe it ended on the 10th or 11th of June. And it only was the next week after that that I actually started in earnest working on the play. So, as I said earlier, the play opens tomorrow, July 20th. So I had between June 11th and July 20th to put together this play, working from the 10-page excerpt I had sent in. So what I quickly found out, which I had had a taste of when I was trying to rehearse my show for the Dallas Solo Fest, is that I don't have the kind of time and resources that I have had in the past now that I am a parent. I know that that's one of the kind of running themes in this particular podcast is me dealing with being a new parent. And one of the things that has to go out the window is uninterrupted branches of time, just spans of time when you can sit down and really focus on something. These spans of time are not available to me any longer. Everything has to be done in at most 20-minute segments. My son is adorable, and I love him dearly, but he can now reach the doorknob and does not realize when I'm speaking in a room on my own that I am not to be disturbed, and he'll just come barreling in the middle of me rehearsing. My wife, though I love her dearly, often multitasks, and sometimes he'll slip away from her while she's watching him, and my son will get out from underneath her notice because she's paying attention to other things, and she has a hard time keeping him away from me while I'm rehearsing. And he, of course, wants to see what I'm up to when I'm gesticulating and switching voices back and forth. Dad's doing something exciting. I want to check it out. So it's made it hard to rehearse. Writing it was a whole other story as well. You also, as an artist, or at least I do, I need uninterrupted time. I need time to concentrate and what I like to call crawl inside the thing. And that was a huge challenge as well. Finding the time to do that on top of regular life things, but add to that parenting. And then very recently, 2 weeks ago, my wife brought home a puppy for my son. And of course, I have been drafted into also taking care of this puppy. Perhaps I'll talk about this in some other episode, but I am not a dog person and never will be a dog person. My wife is very much a dog person. She loves dogs. I do not, and I fought having a dog for a very long time, and only recently have I agreed to go along with this whole buy a dog for my son thing. I don't think kids should be afraid of dogs. I think they should grow up around dogs. I just personally have reached a point in life where I just don't want to add one more thing to my already hectic life. But I'm a parent, and I'm sharing responsibilities, and I love my wife, and I love my son, and so a dog has appeared in my life, and it also demands attention, it also demands love, and it also demands time. So all this is to say, there was a lot of pushback, a lot of, as Stephen Pressfield would say, resistance. To me, writing the piece originally and then later on rehearsing this brand new play. So, several weeks ago, I had the first paper tech, and I had not finished the play. I had a mostly completed draft ready when I showed up to the paper tech. If you're not familiar with the theater, a paper tech is a preparation meeting to decide what you need when the technical rehearsals come along, so that nothing is left out, nothing is forgotten. I had a rough idea of what the set would look like. It had taken me several incarnations to put together an actual way to tell the story. I had the story laid out. The plot was kind of laid out in my mind. Like, this was going to happen, then this was going to happen, and the next was going to happen. It would build to this. This would be the climax, and so on and so forth. How to tell that story went through many different versions. At first, I was going to have the person in an asylum, and this protagonist would be bringing back this crazy story that happened, and we find out by the end of the play that they're in some sort of mental institution and trying to plead their case to the kind of like probationary officers. I abandoned that at some point, and then I was going to set the entire play in a pub and have the story come out as a drinking tale. The person would be basically drinking beer the whole time and telling the story to the audience who were like supposed to be other patrons there in the tavern. What I ultimately ended up on was a sort of speech, like a lectern standing at a lectern at a podium and presenting sort of a report to some sort of like adventure society, like a National Geographic-y sort of club. And the audience are the members who have assembled to hear the story of this expedition by the lone survivor of the expedition. So the, as I think I said before, if I didn't, the title of the play is The Beast of Hyperborea. And it is about a ragtag group of adventurers who seek out this recently discovered island up by the Arctic Circle off the coast of Scotland that is rumored to be Hyperborea, the land beyond the far northern winds as referenced in Greek mythology. And on this island, the original discoverer of the island encountered some sort of giant, a beast of a man that was like twice the size of a regular person. And the person that discovered it, his name is Clemino, dies, but not before leaving a record of his encounter in his journals. And he sends it to his friend, Captain Saltwood, a airship captain. And Captain Saltwood puts together a team of people. The story is told through the perspective of the most minor member of this expedition, an accountant who answered basically a classified ad and then stumbled into the expedition. So not an accomplished adventurer, knowledgeable about some specific crazy field of study, but just like a bookkeeper, basically. And he gets dragged along in this adventure and proves to be the only person left to tell the tale at the end of it. And I wanted to do sort of an homage to these adventure stories, but I also wanted it to be with this little theme underneath it that adventures have fallout. There can be the character doesn't have necessarily PTSD, but does have hugely affected by the aftermath of this so-called adventure. And it's kind of this buildup of the adventure story as glorified, but then kind of anchoring it with some real world like ramifications that if this stuff was to really happen, it would really have major consequences. So that's the idea I was working with. After the paper tech, I had a week later my first technical rehearsal, and I managed to finish the full draft of the show. Now, the show has to run under 50 minutes performance time, which is pretty fast, by the way. And it sets it up for a festival-length show for me to take in the future. But my first draft was very long. It was 28 pages of dense text. And for a one-person show, that is around an hour and 5 hour and 10 minutes. Anyway, this is the script I took to the tech rehearsal, and we set cues at the beginning of the play and at the end of the play, but no internal cues. So there were sound cues and light cues, and basically I said, I want lights up at the beginning and then turn the lights off at the end. I want intro music to bring the play in, and then outro music at the end to set the mood as the play finishes. The lighting designer, a very sweet young lady named Jessica, seemed very young and energetic, suggested that she design some lights to put in the play as it goes along. And I said, sure, knock yourself out. Thinking to myself, well, I'm going to do the play as I'm going to do the play anyway. But if she has some ideas, go to town. That's not a problem with me. I had slides that show up at the end, and I had to make a old school looking projector as a prop. There were no projectors, so to speak, in 1895 when the play is set. So I had come up with this contraption that I had imagined that would show slides by candlelight, and it had to look like the prop was doing it. But of course, they would be actually projected on a scrim at the back of the theater from an actual projector. But I had to make the prop, and I had to make the slides that slide through the prop. And that was an experiment all on its own, separate from the technical rehearsals. So I got through the first tech, and I just basically read the play. And because the technical rehearsal is much longer than the play itself is going to be, nobody noticed that it was really over time. And I sped through it. I just literally stood in the middle of the stage and read as fast as I could. And it was a huge wake-up call because this was a week and a half ago when my first tech was. No, 2 weeks ago now. So 2 weeks ago, I got a big splash of water in the face and saying, hey, you're going to do a show and it's going to happen 2 weeks from now and you need to be ready and you are not. Your script is not done. It is too long. You are not up to performing it yet. You don't have it memorized. You don't have any of the characters set. You're just standing in the middle of the stage reading it. I got home that night just horribly demoralized. My wife, who is wonderful about supporting me in these things, kind of gave me a half-hearted pep talk, and she was like, you can do it. Don't worry. It all works out. And I kind of joked that I'm like, no, but this time I think I might actually embarrass myself. I might not be ready in time. This is a tremendous undertaking that I've made myself to create something from scratch and not just write it, but also perform it and design it myself and have it ready to do. And the entire production is on my shoulders. I don't have a stage manager. I don't have a director. It's just me. And I'm the only one driving it. So I have to figure out a way to make it happen. And I have this personal philosophy in life. And I don't know if I've mentioned it on this podcast before or not. My personal philosophy is that anything is possible. And most things will work out. But in order for them to do so, I must struggle. So I must metaphorically walk over broken glass barefooted. And then when I do so, the outcome is usually successful. 95% of the time it is successful. But it's only successful in my mind because I put the work in. If I take shortcuts, if I try to hack my way around it, if I don't put in the long hours and the concentration and try my best, try my hardest, and actually struggle to make it happen, then I deserve whatever the consequences are, and the consequences are often less than successful. So this is a personal philosophy I have in life. Things will work out, but they only work out because you pay the price for them to work out. And if you aren't prepared to pay the price, you must accept the consequences of them not working out. And I kind of joke sometimes to my family and to my wife and friends that this is hard. I might not be able to do this. And because I've been doing it for so long, I'm involved in the theater now for almost 30 years, they usually disregard this. They're like, oh, Brad's being modest. Brad's just blowing smoke. But this time around, it was hard to iterate to my friends that this, I'm serious. Like, I am scared, legitimately scared, that I will not have this made up to par and ready to go in time. And when I say up to par, I mean above performance level standards. My particular standards for myself are much higher than anybody around me. And I seldom meet my own standards in the best of conditions, let alone when I'm against, you know, behind the eight ball on stuff. So being behind on this, I was legitimately scared. I know that in the long run, I will put this show together. And I know that it will be a struggle and I will have to sacrifice many things to do it, to rehearse it, to write it, to rehearse it, to design it. I cannot spend time with my kid and rehearse. I cannot spend time with my wife and write the play. I cannot hang out with friends or go on extended family vacations. I cannot just randomly go out to eat, to the movies, sit down and watch Stranger Things season 3. I can't do all these things that I would normally be doing in life because I have this project that has to be attended to. And I have to, as I said before, crawl inside of it. And it's only once I'm inside of it that I can actually create it, like actually make it happen. In the writing part, this was one thing to sit at the computer and do this. But in rehearsals, it means getting up on my feet in a place where I have space to move and time to speak the words over and over again, to develop the characters and make their voices distinct. to make the motivations clear, to make the story come across clearly. And I don't have that at my house. I had to basically go to my parents' home, and I would go to their guest room and close the door while they were across the house and watching TV, and I would rehearse at their house in their tiny little guest bedroom, because I couldn't rehearse at my house. As I said before, I had the same problems I had during the Dallas Solo Fest, with my child wanting to be a part of what I was doing, my wife unable to keep him away from me, her needing things from me as well, life just getting in the way. I don't have complete freedom as I used to have as a younger man, and I don't have the energy I used to have as a younger man. On top of all this, I started teaching summer school in the mornings for the last several weeks, so I've had to go to bed early and then get up early, which means no working into the night, because I have a job to do the next day. I have classes to teach, and so that has also had to be taken into consideration. I had the first tech. I was demoralized. I had a family vacation and then a second tech. The first tech was on a Thursday night, and then I had, a Wednesday night. Then Thursday, the next day, I left for San Antonio with my family, and we like toured the Alamo and went to SeaWorld and things. And while I was on vacation, I took time to rehearse in the hotel room while everybody was out taking like a riverboat ride or something. And I ran lines in the car on the drive down there. I run lines every time I get in my car now. And then the next second tech was on Monday of this week, and it went well. I cut the play down. Ultimately, I cut the play after four drafts down to 20 pages. So 20 pages I can do in 45 minutes, not a problem. But I had only memorized the play up to page 13 or so. So when I showed up to do the second tech and we ran the show, the whole show ran off the rails a little over halfway through it. And again, I had a huge slap in the face, a huge wake-up call, a splash of cold water in my face, because I realized, oh crap, I've done all this work and I'm still nowhere near ready. This play is only half put together and it hasn't been rehearsed enough, and I don't know if it's going to be rehearsed enough. So I worked for the next couple of days. My final dress rehearsal was Wednesday. So I had from Monday night to Wednesday night, so 2.5 days, to keep rehearsing the play and have everything ready to go by dress rehearsal. So I had to have all of the set pieces complete, all of the props that I had been working on complete, and I had to have the play performance ready by Wednesday night. And I did. My dress rehearsal went successfully. It went very solid. If I were rating the show, I would call it a 75-80% show. So it was not super. It was not spectacular, but it was solid. The story got across. I only missed a couple of things, and the things that I missed are things that I would notice, but the audience wouldn't necessarily notice. And I drove home telling my wife on the phone on the drive home that, hey, I pulled it off. I was able to do it once. And if I can do it once all the way through without stopping, I can make the story make sense, I can make it exciting and the characters are distinct, then I can do it again. But I am also aware that there is a trap involved in that. And the trap is that I will relax before opening night. So between Wednesday night and this and Saturday night, tomorrow night, I still have been rehearsing. I have rehearsed 2 or 3 times a day since then. And when I say rehearse, now I'm just running the play over and over and over again. I'm running the play to get the pace down. I'm running the play to make the characters more clear, the story come across more precisely, to hit the emotional highs and the lows, and just bring it up to par. The trick now that it's solid is to go from solid to good, and then from good to great. And once it's great and consistently great, then I will relax, because that's closer to my bar, to my standards. So that's where it rests right now. It's funny, at the dress rehearsal, the dress run the other day, the final dress, the producer of this particular festival is an old friend of mine named David, and he went to college with me. So we've been in the theater together for a long time, and I could see that he was visibly worried about me during the first tech, and then the second tech, it didn't let up, but I did see him relax during the final dress finally, and which is good. I didn't want him to worry about me, bringing the goods, so to speak. I also was approached by Jessica, the lighting designer, and she approached me, and it was kind of funny. She's new to the fit, or I think she's new to the fit, and she's been watching all these other companies. There's 7 or 8 other companies in the festival, and the impetus, the impulse is to bring your show to your technical rehearsals and to your final dress ready to go, because the crew's watching. So when I did performances in the past with other productions for the fit, I would try to show up to the technical rehearsals very professionally. Like we're already ready. It's just fine to, it's just tweaking it now. We're already ready. Even when I was directing other actors and not solo shows, I would have everybody over rehearse as we get ready to go into technical rehearsals so that we could show the fit like, hey, don't worry about us. We're ready. We're ready. But I have no such vanity now that I'm an older artist and that I've done the fit a variety of times and it's a solo show. So although I was pressured to prepare the show myself, I definitely did not feel that I needed to show the crew who are there ultimately to support me in the fit that I was anything other than a hot mess. So the lighting designer came after watching other performers and she's like, most people pretend like they're ready even when they're not, but you didn't do that. And she meant it as a compliment. And she's like, it's been a really nice treat to watch you build this show. Every time you've come back from one tech to the next tech to the dress rehearsal, I can tell that you've been rehearsing it. You've been working on it. And it's gotten better. I've seen you literally build this show in front of us. And it's kind of a treat. So I'm very happy that your dress rehearsal went well and all the best with it. And she totally meant it as a compliment. And I took it as a compliment as well. But she kind of pointed out, like, you don't even pretend like you're ready. You have no vanity about this project whatsoever. You just showed up as a complete mess, and then it was a little bit less of a mess, and now it's not a mess, but it wasn't performance level for me yet. Like it was, I pulled it off. Pulling it off and actually excelling at something are two different things. So I will finish this podcast next time. I'll do like a really short little follow-up after tomorrow night to let everybody know how opening night went. I could blank out. I could skip huge chunks of the play. Props could break. 101 things could go wrong. Maybe I don't have the energy to really drive the play forward as quickly and as dynamically as it needs to go. This show exhausts me to no end. I do a physical flip in the middle of the show. I play these outrageous characters. There's fight scenes. There's aerial battles with huge raptors aboard as a protagonist or aboard an airship. There's mountain climbing. There's all kinds of stuff in this play that physically exhausts me. But mentally, I have to keep driving it. If I let any air in to the play when there's not supposed to be, it will flatten it out, and I can't have that. So we'll see how it goes tomorrow night. I just wanted to give everybody a little glimpse of, like, that's what I'm dealing with right now. And I would like to say here to end, besides all the other challenges that have come up as I've put this play together, as I've fought the clock and fought for rehearsal time and my responsibilities in life and vacations and parenting and so on and so forth, on top of all of this, I'm burnt out. I struggled for a while to see why I should even keep doing this. I contemplated contacting David at the fit and just saying, listen, I'm sorry, I have to drop out. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I'm not enthusiastic about this. I don't have the passion right now. But I didn't do that. I told people that I was going to do this show. I signed a contract to do a show in a festival. And so I have made this show. And it is ultimately, now that I've gotten through all of the hard work that front loads these kind of projects, I've gotten to the fun part of actually performing it and trying to perform it better and better each time. But it's been a long way around the barn to get there. After this project, I think I'm hanging it up for a little while. I mean, I'll still do this podcast from time to time, and I'll still, you know, work on plays here and there privately, but I think I'm going to drop out of the public eye for a while. So this will be my little swan song in the theater for the near foreseeable future. At least until my kid's a little bit older and my home situation changes and I get the restlessness again. I get that itch to want to make something, that drive. When I get that back, then I ride it out. But at the moment, I am running on fumes and I'm struggling. I'm fighting not just going through the motions. I'm fighting to stay in it, to keep my brain in it and keep my body in it and make it the best it can possibly be. If I'm going to stop for a while, I'm not going to go out on a whimper. I'm going to go out on a bang. So I have to keep that in mind. Anyway, until part 2.